8 minutes past the hour. Shall we get Tony Gosling on, shall we? Let's do it! Love chatting with Tony Gosling, top man, the host of the politics show on Bristol's BC FM, former BBC journalist. While we dial Tony up, let's have some Snow Patrol. This is Chocolate. What a tune this is! On Europe's most listened to independent radio show, The Richie Allen Show. Yeah, you gotta love Gary Lightbody, Snow Patrol there on The Richie Allen Show, 10 minutes past the hour. It's glorious outside the studio looking out the window there. That is glorious. Unbelievable. Apparently we're going to have 17, 18 degrees here in Madchester later on in the week. Yes. I won't be making any excuses. I'll be here every day this week, Monday to Thursday. Tony Gosling is a legend. You know Tony very well. The presenter of the brilliant politics show on BCFM in Bristol. The man behind Bilderberg.org, former BBC journalist. And he's a great sport because he jumped in today, short notice, which a lot of people in Tony's position wouldn't do. But he's a great sport. Loads to talk about. Thisweek.org.uk. I know you know that, but if you haven't been on there before, get on there. Tony, thanks for coming on, mate. How are you?
I think you're peddling conspiracy theories on this programme if you're talking about it not raining in Manchester.
I know, yeah, yeah. It's been lovely, and apparently for the rest of the week we're going to get kind of unseasonably warm weather. It must be global warming. Now,
well, let's hope something good is going on anyway. We deserve a little bit of cheering up. Actually, I've noticed just people on the streets the last couple of days have been quite, with a bit of a spring in their step. It's lovely this time of year, isn't it? When you get a bit of outbreak of a bit of warmth and sunshine, it just cheers everybody up.
Everybody's in good form, yes. Spring has sprung. Now, thanks to me inviting you on last minute today, I realised, but again, only thanks to you, that next week or the 4th of April, it's amazing how time flies doing this particular job, and you've done it for years, so you know better than anybody. The 4th will see a year since the Skripals collapsed inexplicably in Salisbury and were attended to by a chief of the army medical person, and then were spirited away to hospital. Mad, so let's start with that, because
This is the first thing. Before it even happened, you've got the chief of the army's, senior nurse in the whole of the British Army, almost certainly, you know, close connections to the intelligence services, is there on the scene. And what does she do? She sends her daughter in, with no kind of protection whatsoever, to deal with a nerve gas attack. So, I mean, you've got to question as to whether she really believes it's nerve agent involved, if she's sending her daughter into the middle of the fray to deal with it. So, I mean, the whole business of the Skripals, I think, is unravelling and unravelling. It sometimes takes months. But then, of course, it falls off the news agenda. The news media aren't interested anymore. The basic facts, like, was this bottle of perfume, which was supposedly used to apply this deadly chemical to the door handle, why did it then get found back in a sealed bottle in a sealed container again? I mean, were these Russians so clever they had some little cellophane device to seal it all back together? These basic kind of things aren't looked at. I mean, there's another narrative that's been emerging the last few months, Richie, and I'm sure you're aware of this, and that is that there is a fascinating explanation for Bellingcat's interesting little revelation that there was another seat booked on the plane back to Russia, where these two guys were supposed to have come over to Salisbury, which they obviously were. They were photographed in Salisbury. And there was another seat booked back on that plane in another name. Now, the obvious conclusion here is that that person may have been Sergei Skripal. Yeah. And he may have been planning to go back. In fact, there's an article in The Independent as soon as this all happened a year ago. Well, it's just over a year ago now, and The Independent saying that he planned to return to Russia, which most people just scooted over that. But it was in The Independent. It was quite well, you know, known that he'd expressed potential, you know, going back to Russia. Now, that's the sort of thing you might not necessarily do if you're a spy, especially if you're a former spy that's been involved in creating this completely fictional Steele dossier, which was used to try and bring Trump down during the last election campaign. So it's not the Russians interfering. This is MI6 interfering in the US elections. So that seems to me to be the most likely explanation here, is that the two guys turned up in Salisbury with a false passport, made out false Skripal with his picture on and a false identity, and he was planning to go back to Russia and spill the beans on what MI6 and the Western intelligence services have been up to. But of course, once MI6 got wind of this, they were about to take some pretty drastic measures to stop Sergei Skripal going back and making, you know, an immense amount of fun on the TV over in Russia. But the other thing I've been looking at since all this, Richie, is Novichok. What is this stuff? No one had ever heard of it beforehand. Except, by the way, in a couple of TV dramas which had aired just a few months before this attack. I think it was just before and just after Christmas, each side of the Atlantic. It popped up in some drama series. No one had ever heard of it before. Anyway, it looks like, I mean, my digging around, I don't know if you've come across this, but it looks to me as if Novichok is a complete fake. It doesn't actually exist. And it was set up by the Russians back in the Cold War in the 1970s and 80s as a fake load of documents which were given to someone they suspected of being a NATO spy in order to see whether the Western intelligence services would get hold of all this information of a supposedly new type of nerve agent. What it was, apparently, was a whole load of sort of chemical, you know, it's like a formula, you know, the traditional formula we see in films, spy secret formula.
Wow.
But if anyone was an expert in organic chemistry, they'd look at all that and they'd say, well, look, this is rubbish. That actually doesn't make sense. But anyone who was an agent might look at it and think, crikey, this is really important. I'm going to pass this back to the West. And so that's what Novichok was. It didn't actually exist as a real chemical agent. It was just basically a fake document, a fake chemical, which was used to weed out who were the NATO spies within the Russian structures. And so that is, I suppose, there's not much else of use for that other than to see who is stupid enough, who is inexpert enough to believe this. So that's where I'm at, looking at what Novichok is. I don't think it doesn't even exist as a real nerve agent.
Now, why wouldn't the Russians have said that themselves, what you've just told us there? Because what you've told me there is plausible enough to me. The Russians should surely come out and say that.
They don't say anything more than they have to.
Right.
That's the way these things work, I think. And they're just waiting to see who is going, see if anyone else is going to realise this. I mean, I think because the tension is now ramping, I mean, we've had a massive number of scores of diplomatic expulsions because of this, and a ramping up of tension. That really, I think, the real reason for that ramping up of tension has nothing to do with Novichok or Salisbury or Skripal or anything else. It's all to do with the Russian success in stopping the NATO and the West's plans and the Israeli plans in Syria to kick out President Assad. The Russians have stopped that, and so they've got to find some sort of way of getting back at them.
Tony Gosling is our guest. That's a really interesting theory, that. It really is. I've had tweets on this. When you come on, we get reams and reams of tweets, of course, coming in. In this together, I love my Twitter pals with their lovely names. Didn't the Iranians synthesize Novichok, Tony, from the book formula in 2016 and hand their work to the OPCW? Because this could all be misinformation, but we did hear about the possibility of buying a book on Amazon with the ingredients for Novichok. I don't know. I like your theory, to be honest.
It's feasible, but the thing is, these things get passed around, and only when someone who is a qualified chemist has actually made the stuff and tested it do we actually know if it's real.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly know that nerve agents, which were originally developed as based on organophosphates by the Nazi scientists during the Second World War, and then greedily taken up by the Brits and the Americans after World War II, and then, of course, once one side's got it, then the other side's got to have it. They've got to develop antidotes. We've got things like VX, and they quite clearly are. But the other thing, of course, about the Salisbury story, why this doesn't make any sense, is that But this stuff is incredibly deadly, allegedly. And if it had been used on the Skripals, Yulia and Sergei Skripal in Salisbury, they would both be dead. They weren't dead. They were paralyzed in some way, and they were delirious. So this looks to me like some kind of chemical.
Hallucinogenic or something.
It seems to me that is what was used on them. Of course, if Sergei was about to try and go back to Russia and spill the beans on the Steele dossier, and that was another really important angle on this story, of course, is Alex Thompson, bless him, from Channel 4 News, telling the world that there was a D-notice on, I mean, of course, there's also always rumours, but, you know, when we've had it from Alex at Channel 4 News, we know, I think, that there is a D-notice on Pablo Miller, who was the guy who was Sergei Skripal's handler. So they are happy for everyone to know all about Sergei Skripal, but the intelligence services here in Britain don't want anybody to know about who was controlling him, who was moving, and which side he might have been on. So that's another angle on this, you know, that does make you very, very suspicious about, you know, is he really just acting on his own, or is he about to turn back to working for the Russians, and MI6 have just intervened and said, he ain't doing that. Forget it, mate.
By the way, Tony's on, of course, just for our listeners who don't know, listening overseas maybe, a D-notice is when news organizations are given an official request not to talk about something or not to publish something on any particular subject in relation to national security. Here's a question for you. Love when you come on, because we segue off into different places. How often do you think D-notices are handed to our mainstream media in this country without the knowledge of even intrepid investigators like yourself? How often do you think that goes on?
Yeah, I mean, remember, there's really only a handful of editors that are given they're actually called DA notices, Defence Advisory Notices, and the old term is D notice, but that's still what's used. I mean, the other big question here is, why would an editor not just ignore it and say, I'm going to publish this anyway? Well, the answer is because they will never get any information from the Ministry of Defence or from defence sources again. Or at least certainly they'll be put on the blacklist for a few years. So they are very much aware that if they go against what they're being told, that they'll be completely frozen out from the sources that they need for their daily news. I would suggest, yes, you're probably talking about every few months something like this being issued. It's just quite rare, and it's, I mean, real big pat on the back to Alex Thompson for, you know, I hope I don't get him sacked for saying this, but, you know, big pat on the back for him for sharing it, because most of the time they look at it and they go, okay, well, we can't talk about that. It's really just a 1984 style censorship instrument. So when there's something really important the public needs to know, they will say, of course, oh, it's all national security, which is just bunkum. In fact, another reason apparently that you can issue a DA notice is if it's to do with finance. So if it looks as if there could be big financial implications for the country in saying something, then no matter if it's, you know, that Britain is involved in some massive international fraud, you can't report it because a DA notice has been issued to stop you.
I want to, just before we move on, I want to mention this. Just give me 25 seconds here, Tone, please. Tony Gosling is the presenter of the politics show on BCFM in Bristol. When I say that it's a magnificent programme and it's brilliantly produced and it's eminently listenable, I mean it. I wouldn't say that, and I very rarely say it about anything. I've known Tony since my days in Spain 10, 11 years ago. He's a fantastic presenter and producer, and his programmes are fair. And when he claims to have some information, he can back it up with hard evidence to prove that what he is saying is true. When it's conjecture and it's supposition, Tony will always flag it up and say, well, look, this is what I'm thinking at the moment. A short time ago, a group calling themselves the UK Lawyers for Israel took exception to Tony's programme and made a report or made a complaint to Ofcom, the official, which is the regulatory authority for broadcast media in this country. It could have been it was serious, but it could have been very serious for Tony, whose work is impeccable. It's shot through with brilliant journalism and reporting, and there isn't an ounce of racism or hatred or anything like that in his work. Thanks be to Jesus, Ofcom saw through the spurious and ridiculous claim by UK Lawyers for Israel, and they found in favour of Tony's programme and the radio station BCFM. You must have been a little bit worried, mate, because that was serious stuff. I mean, the implications for that, for Ofcom saying, oh, well, we'll uphold the complaint. The implications were pretty shocking for you. I'm so thrilled that you won that, and I know you move on from here, but have you got a quick word on that for us, Tony?
Well, first of all, I gave Ofcom quite a lot of help. I mean, I spent 3 days or so doing a submission to Ofcom to explain why the programmes were not biased against Israel and were not biased against MI5. And I also did a complete takedown, because actually I was rather disappointed that Ofcom took seriously the idea that a programme was dealing with conspiracy theories and that could possibly be a breach of their code.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the term conspiracy theory doesn't actually mean anything. What we're talking about is a term which was invented by the CIA in 1967 to stop criticism of the Warren Commission and to stop journalists looking into the death of President Kennedy. The term means what you're doing, using the term, is you're mixing up real conspiracies with fake conspiracies. And so actually the term you really should be using, if you're looking at what we do, is investigative journalism. But no, they're saying, what we do on our program is look at the moon landings being faked. We look at the British government being controlled by lizards. We look at all sorts of other silly ideas, which we don't. What we're doing is a fairly serious job, I think, in trying to weed out the rubbish and ignoring it generally, and looking at the real conspiracies, because there are real conspiracies, people making billions. I mean, one of the ones we were looking at this week is to do with Lloyds Bank, which are alleged, not by me, but by the Police and Crime Commissioner of Thames Valley Police, Anthony Stansfield, to be involved in anything up to £1 billion fraud, but they haven't been prosecuted. Now, this is a potential real conspiracy, and that's what we're interested in. You know, Bristol branch of some bank, which is defrauding people, and the police aren't investigating it, allegedly. You know, so this term conspiracy theory, I was really disappointed to see Ofcom took that seriously. At the other end of the complaint, though, it was really interesting to see, just as our verdict came out, a publication on Mondawise website, which was a brilliant takedown of UK lawyers for Israel, really explaining that the genesis of this little group was nothing more or less than the Israeli Foreign Ministry itself, and that there were, it's all peppered through with all sorts of suggestions that the people working for it now is some sort of front, effectively, for the Israeli government. So I was quite shocked to see that it was a direct, you know, this is certainly what it looks like, a direct threat against what I'm doing here in Bristol as, in terms of journalism, from the Israeli state itself.
But it
and
was.
That money.
It was.
Sorry?
It was. Listen, yeah. some listeners might think, oh, that's a bit much. No, it was. I've looked at this particular group myself. This is a group directly influenced, controlled by elements of the Israeli government. There's no two ways about that. You're absolutely right to say that.
Yeah, and people are obviously sympathetic with the Israeli state. Now, let's just remind ourselves who and what the Israeli state are. They are now a extreme racist fundamentalist state that is involved in systematic demonization and hate speech against the entire indigenous population, which is the Palestinians. You know, this is not very neighborly for people to turn up as migrants from other parts of the world and to, I mean, really what there should be is a massive boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign in the same way as we had in South Africa to get them back into line, to stop the racism. And yet what we see is a very active racist state now trying to stop any criticism of it anywhere out in the, particularly in the Western world. I mean, you'll find some parts of the world where the Israelis don't get such an easy time. One of them is New Zealand, where this Christchurch attack happened, by the way, and also in Malaysia, where Zippy Livni and other senior Israelis have been put on trial for war crimes and found guilty in absentia, so they can't go to Malaysia. I mean, admittedly, that the president there is a bit anti-Semitic. You know, he crosses the line there. But the fact of the matter is that there are people who are criticising Israel, but there are very, very few of them in the Western world. And, you know, I just think it's so important that this happens in order to put some pressure on the Israeli state to stop the racist attacks on the Palestinians over there, because it's getting really crazy. It's also being fueled by poisonous hate speech by Christian Zionists in America, particularly. There's this guy called, John MacArthur? I don't know if you've ever come across him. He's, makes John Hagee look like a puppy dog. And he basically says that the hero of Islam and the Muslims and the Hadiths, which are a bit like the Talmud in Judaism, which are kind of, you know, writings of the rabbis or writings of the mullahs, saying that the Mahdi, who is the great hero of the Quran in the end times, is the Antichrist. So what they're doing is they're planting in many Christian, deluded Christian minds that they've got to just kind of kill Muslims and stop Muslims. So this is really fueling this diseased sort of minded attitude of the racists in Israel, and there are, I mean, there's an election campaign going on there now that actually encourages them to think that Muslims are the Antichrist followers, you know. So this kind of stuff really needs to be called out, I think, and at least, at the very least, discussed, because it's not being discussed anywhere in the media as far as I can see at all.
No, I mean, it comes up all the time on this particular program, and
We've had everything from ISIS, haven't we? We've had all this stuff about, the caliphate, and this is all this is being used to recruit people. We've had all that, but we haven't had the other side of the coin at all, and so that's one of the things I've been trying to do.
Two issues that, if we can stay with this for a minute before we talk, maybe we'll talk a little bit about Christchurch in a sec, but before we do that, two things. The Israeli Defense Forces said 7 people were injured, British Israeli family in Tel Aviv because of a rocket. Netanyahu has got problems, domestic problems, of course, investigations going on there. He said there'll be a heavy response. It's been 5 years since the so-called Operation Protective Edge. Some would say that Israel is due to bombard Gaza again. Please God, it won't happen. But on that, what about this phenomenon of the far right kind of, you've just touched on it there, merging with Zionists? This is really interesting because traditionally the far right, particularly in America, blamed Jews for everything and hated Jews and openly discussed hating Jews, and Jews were the devil and all the rest of it. What we've seen in recent years, even in this country, with the knuckle draggers, whose name I won't mention, kind of aligning themselves with Zionism. Strange times, Tony.
Well, look, I mean, we had a guy called Mark Smullyan, who's a Jewish musician here in Bristol, on our program on Friday. He's anti-Zionist, he's Jewish, and there are millions of Jewish people out there who are now looking at the state of Israel and saying, good God, you know, how do we stop this? And of course, they're generally, I mean, many, many Jewish families are actually very left-wing, and they don't agree with the racism.
Absolutely.
But the thing is, how do they stop it? How do you stop it when you're not actually given an airing? This is why I do everything I can to get, Jewish people on the radio talking, ordinary Jewish people, rather than the Zionists, who seem to me to be the epitome of this term fundamentalist. They absolutely believe that God has given them this land and to do what they want with, and also exclusively to them. So everybody else has to go by one means or another. So this, I think, is a very dangerous way of thinking, you know, and the speech that goes with it is got to be called, just as, you know, many of the Muslim hate preachers were called, hate speech. And this kind of thing just needs to be, it certainly needs to be challenged. I mean, I don't think you should actually ban these rather poisonous pastors from saying what they say, etc. But it needs to be challenged in the mainstream press. And the mainstream press is just simply not doing their job. And if they don't do their job, then it's going to inevitably, I think, lead to some kind of crisis. But we've got to make it absolutely clear. Zionism and Judaism, and even just ordinary, you know, this whole term Jewish to define a race of people, completely separate things. Zionism is this fanatical, nationalistic and very right-wing thing. In fact, by the way, of course, I don't, you probably know that Tommy Robinson in this country, his court case was funded by Zionist institutions.
That's right.
So they are very, very much involved in the far right. Also worth looking at, do you remember Anders Breivik? I think it was 2011. The
2011,
attack where he killed 70 people over in Norway. I think very similar to this thing over in Christchurch, because it was an attempt to take a peaceful country that's on the periphery of world affairs, that's trusted, whose passports are trusted, and that country is also used often in mediation around the world. Say there's some sort of conflict going on, wherever it happens to be, India, Pakistan, or whatever. Oh, we'll bring in someone from Norway or someone from New Zealand who's trusted to be a mediator to calm the conflict down. So New Zealand, like Norway, has now been brought in to this whole conflict by the act of a fanatical far-right, you know, lunatic, basically, someone who's obsessed, possibly even, I might go so far as to say this, Richie, mind-controlled, possibly even programmed in some way to just hate people. I mean, I know one thing, he was really into these violent video games, and it seems to me he thought he was playing some kind of violent video game. We got so obsessed with them that he decided to try and make it a reality. One of the things we looked at on Friday was the this whole thing of Netanyahu saying that, oh, New Zealand is that's a declaration
that's
of war,
right,
on Israel.
That's right, yeah, do you remember that?
Obviously New Zealand are not declaring war on anybody, except apparently in Netanyahu's mind, on him. Because the New Zealanders sponsored a motion at the United Nations condemning Israeli settlements on the West Bank and in Gaza and stealing land, which is a great thing to do, you know. But no, Netanyahu says, no, that's a declaration of war. Now, when Netanyahu says it's a declaration of war, does that mean he would justify sending some sort of special forces person in to kill people in New Zealand? I mean, who knows? But there's also been a long history of interference in New Zealand by the Israeli state, by the Mossad, by the intelligence services, in there trying to steal New Zealand identities. Now, by stealing passports and by stealing information, then applying for passports of New Zealanders, because they know that those New Zealand passports will allow their agents under false identities to go almost anywhere to do things like sabotage and commit assassinations. So there is quite a tense relationship over the last 4 or 5 years between New Zealand and Israel, which has been very much under the radar.
I saw quite a bit of the video. And it's my belief that even though there are some strange things going on in the video, it's my belief that the kid, I suppose he's not a kid, but he went in there and he began killing people. I've no doubt in my mind that's what happened. And, you know, I could be wrong. What concerns me, Tony, is having watched it a few times, is this character that keeps popping up in the video, the guy with the red coat on him, the guy with the red jacket. And I've looked at this several times, and I'm a huge skeptic, you know. People jump in the independent media with both feet, and they don't pause, and they jump to conclusions all the time. Not you, but you know the people we're talking about. Everything is a hoax, and everything is a false flag. Everything was a military operation. Hang on a second. Look at it. Dispassionately calm down. And I've kind of kept my powder dry, and I've had a good look at this over the last few days. And what I'm seeing in this video is one really glaring anomaly. And maybe this is the reason that they're talking about putting people in prison for sharing the video. And this is this guy who keeps popping up in it with the red jacket. And to me, and this is just conjecture because I know nothing about this type of thing. To me, I can understand why somebody might think Handler, right there. Who is this guy? Have you noticed this, Tony? Have you seen this in the video? It's rather strange.
I don't know. I think the guy's working on his own, actually. The other thing is, I think that I love the way Jacinda Ardern has reacted to this by saying, no, we're not going to use his name.
I just think
it's such an imaginative, and it's brilliant that the New Zealanders have come up. They've got real leadership there with something that the Western, it doesn't even occur to any of our Western puppets. That she's saying, no, we're not going to use this guy's name. I would also say, though, that the knee-jerk reaction in banning guns over there is not going to stop someone doing this again.
No, but isn't that pathetic, Tony?
Just for the public.
Hang on a second. I'm going to argue with you here now.
The second mosque he went to, I think it was incredible to see the people actually with as one or two of them, weren't there, who are so courageous with unarmed, except with one of those little cash machine type things, to take the guy on, to pick up an empty gun and to threaten him. I don't think there was a handler. As far as I can see, there's nothing there. Red jacket, I didn't see that.
It looks
to me like this guy is basically a Breivik character, the same kind of guy who has decided that Muslims are the biggest evil thing in the entire planet, not him, No, they are. And that he's just going to kill as many as he can. And he's been sent there to do that in order to try and traumatise New Zealand, to bring them into the much bigger war, which is, you know, is being fermented out there, essentially, you know, between Russia and the States, between Israel and Iran, and effectively a religious war centred around Jerusalem, potentially, into the future.
I go along with quite a lot of that, or most of it. I don't doubt the kid had some involvement in it. I'm not convinced he was on his own, but I completely respect what you said there. I'm going to argue with you about Jacinda Ardern. I think she's pathetic. I think the notion that you wouldn't use the guy's name is laughable and trite and tripe and pathetic. It could be that, well, let's forget all about this guy. Let's not look at the fact that he travelled in Pakistan, that he was in Turkey twice. That he was Let me finish, Tone. I didn't interrupt you. Let me finish, then I'll shut up and I'll get out of your way. Hang on a second. She's not... She is completely shutting down any investigation into this guy, number one. And number two, all this hijab-wearing, hugging Muslims and all that, that's just virtue-signalling crap. People want answers, not virtue-signalling prime ministers. Go ahead, Tone.
Well, look, where do I start? Okay, so I think the idea that you're, I mean, the press, I noticed straight away after Christchurch, we're looking at him, his family, wasn't he a lovely little boy, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I think she's absolutely right to say he is not the most important person here. The most important person we should be looking at are the victims' families, the survivors, all these people. Some of them incredible characters. That is, I think she's absolutely right to do that. And I think it's a model, in fact, for any kind of future terror attacks that happen. And of course there will be more, that we do look at the victim end of things,
yes,
rather than
who can argue with you?
This guy obviously did this kind of thing wanting to be notorious, wanting to be feared, wanting to be well known. And I think she's done the right thing to set the standard, really, to say, let's not, I mean, obviously, we're not saying, don't look at, look at where he's been, what he's done, etc. But the idea that his name is used night after night after night, like we've had, say, for example, with 9/11 and, the use of bin Laden,
yeah,
you know, the idea,
yeah,
of sort of whipping up this crazy frenzy around a particular boogeyman, there always seems to be one, doesn't there? I mean, for a long time,
yeah,
of course, it was Saddam, then it's Gaddafi, then it's Assad. This kind of thing, I think she's absolutely right to at least to make an attempt to stop that kind of demonization, or, you know, making people, I mean, massive figures in the international.
But I don't believe, Tony, that's her motivation. I don't believe that at all. I believe that this guy's movements were key to the lead in that 2-3 year period that led into him doing that, particularly that 43 days he spent in Turkey.
You're absolutely right. The other thing which is key, which has come out about this, is that he was in touch online with Breivik.
Yeah.
So Breivik, in jail, is running his little poisonous far-right Knights Templar network of crazy Christian Zionists in order to encourage them to do this sort of thing, potentially.
And how could that not be monitored? How could that not be monitored, this guy Breivik speaking with this guy? It's incredible.
The hell the Norwegians doing allowing him anywhere near the internet? You know, most people in prison shouldn't, you know, don't have access to the internet unless they bribe somebody or get a phone or whatever. But Breivik should be, I mean, we know. I mean, the only reason, I suppose, in Norway they've allowed him to do this, and of course he had very, very strong pro-Zionist. The other thing with Breivik, you see, was a Freemason. People often forget this. There's loads of pictures of Breivik with his Masonic gear on, and they say Breivik was a lone nutter. Well, of course he wasn't. He was in a lodge with a whole load of Freemasons in a little secret organization. So how you can dare say he's a lone nutter?
He was on his own, yeah.
So why are they letting him anywhere near the internet? Absolutely unbelievable. And that, I suppose, is because they're trying to perpetuate the myth in Norway that he was a lone nutter, and therefore it doesn't do any harm to allow him on the internet. The Norwegians have got to cut off his internet right now, and there needs to be a massive organ. I think all the Western intelligence services need to make sure that nobody from the far right is allowed anywhere near these kind of poisonous. I mean, you know, who knows what sort of stuff he was sharing? I don't know. I think
who
most
knows,
of the
yeah.
But you and I
both know, and one of the reasons I do know is because of my encounters with people like you many moons ago when I started to, you know, move away from commercial media. You know that it's often highly plausible and it's often suspected, and there's often circumstantial evidence, at least, that the very intelligence agencies that we would have cracked down on these guys are often the ones who control their minds or whom
perpetrators.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so there is definitely a wish in all of the Western intelligence services to have pieces on both sides of the chessboard. Okay, so they want to control people on both sides. Now, to what extent those people that they control on each side, I'm talking really here about the far right, Islamist extremist divide, right? To what extent are they using those people to gather intelligence, and to what extent are they controlling them? To what extent are they mind controlling them? To what extent are they actually puppets of those intelligence services doing what the intelligence services tell them to do? There isn't any checks and balances on this at all. I mean, we know this in Britain. It's just simply not happening. With the Intelligence and Security Committee, which is chaired by Dominic Grieve, his committee is hopeless at getting information. They find it very difficult to get intelligence officers to even come to the committee to answer anything, and then it's all done anonymously. So really what you're talking about is a kind of permanent government with the intelligence services able to do pretty much what they want, and then run a kind of a covering operation, a holding operation, in order to try and cover it up. But you're quite right. I think that's exactly what's going on. You've got some players are just being used by these intelligence services for their own purposes, without any real checks and balances. And the media just seem to go along with whatever rubbish story is being cooked up to make an excuse for this happening. But I think that the whole Christchurch business is a bit of a wake-up call, I think, and for many people, and for many intelligence services around the world, will be getting pressure on them to say, well, you've just got to take this far-right threat more seriously. This guy, apparently, is not even on the radar when it comes to the Australian or the New Zealand intelligence services. That's what we were told, anyway. I find that extremely difficult to believe.
We couldn't believe it, yeah. Again, because of the guy's movements, North Korea, Turkey twice. He was in Turkey when there was an attack on Israelis in Turkey, incredibly. Sibel Edmonds has done some pretty brilliant work on it, to be fair to Sibel. I've had her on the programme. Talking about it, got to give her a shout out there. Final word on this then, Tony. You and I have spent many hours on the radio over the years talking about the, I don't want to use the term fallout, but what comes about as a result of these shootings, and it's often increased security. We're hearing things. I've got a friend, Tony, who works for a council in this country. And he's a great source of information, really good guy. And I've got to protect him. You know, I don't have many sources like that. I'd love to say I've got all these sources buried all over the place. I don't. I know you have quite a few. I don't. I've got one or two. My mate who works at a council has said to me, Richie, talks are at an advanced stage to bring in, not now, not in 2020, but maybe in 2022, 2023, to start zoning off city centres and access to city centres in the future only through use of a biometric ID card. So like you've got your Oyster card in London to get on the tram, you will have to have something similar, or on the subway I should say, you've got to have some underground, you've got to have something similar to get into a city centre. And he says this is not being reported by anybody, the press are not picking up on it, but they want to basically zone off city centres in the future. And people will not be able to go down Market Street in Manchester. You'll get to Portland Street, maybe, right? He's not in Manchester City Council. He's further away from Manchester. But just as an example, you'll have to have a card to get from Portland Street to Market Street. There will be a barrier, and it'll be manned by a goon wearing a G4S uniform. And he's been telling me this for about a year now. What do you think? Final word.
Well, I mean, I think, yes, it's feasible. I mean, this whole thing has begun, I suppose, with the congestion charge in London.
Hey, there you go.
Particularly perverse, because it being something where poor people can't afford to go in their cars, and rich people, it's nothing to them. So this is, it will be coming, there are certain zones in the country which are becoming only for rich people. Now, I'm not saying no one can walk into central London, of course they can, but the idea that you've now got a tax which is affects the poor but doesn't affect the rich, you know, a regressive tax, they call it, don't they,
yeah.
on entering parts of the city certainly seems to indicate that that is the sort of thinking that's going on. Like, this place is fast. If you go, if you speak to anyone that's worked at the European Parliament or the European Commission in Brussels, you will find they have a very similar sort of thing there. The entire place is in a massive complex, which is completely sealed off from the outside world, with its own kind of shopping centres, with its own, everything, like swimming pools, this kind of thing. It's like a kind of city within a city, but it's completely sealed off from the outside world. This, I think, indicates the extent to which our politics has become completely removed from ordinary people, and also the mindset of the politicians that are making these decisions, that they are like from another planet. You know, they're another species or something, that they're not subject to the same laws as the rest of us. So they put those barriers there on purpose, I suppose, to assuage the guilt that the decisions that they're making are impoverishing those on the outside of the building.
By the way,
have we got a minute?
We have.
I'd like to just talk about the airliner, because I know we had a fantastic chat last year about the Lion Air crash, didn't we, on the same day that it happened.
That's
over
right.
In Indonesia, and we've seen this incredible, like, basically copycat crash.
Yeah, the 737.
ET-302. Exactly the same thing happened. So the pilots are flying the plane, they switch the autopilot on as they start to head for their destination, as they're on the climb. Suddenly the plane starts to pitch forward all on its own. And then I heard this from someone at the weekend who's in aviation, that on the Lion Air crash, it hasn't been made public, and this is just from an insider, that they had an extra pilot who was just on board, who was shadowing. And he was frantically, as the plane was going down, going through the manual, trying to find out how to turn.
Yeah, I read that.
Autopilot. I mean, this is shocking stuff. And the idea that Boeing would not immediately ground that plane is just absolutely unbelievable. So what we've got now, and I think the reason, this is what I'm trying to get to, the reason that this has not been covered properly by the news media, and the reason that Boeing didn't ground those planes immediately, and they haven't done anything about this horrendous problem. If you wanted to, people are now, you know, wise enough, they won't get onto one of these things. Absolutely mad to get on one. And that's why they had to finally ground them, because the passengers were just refusing to get on them, which is a horrendous state of affairs. Is because there are billions and billions riding on this technology, this autonomous control, self-driving plane, self-driving car world. There are billions and billions of pounds been invested in this, and yet we find it kills people. So we cannot use it. So this is what the massive denial, I think, Richie, from this crash, and the example of Boeing not grounding the planes, the Americans not grounding it. The EU, by the way, only grounded the planes after the British Aviation Authority did here, you know, the domestic one, and the Europeans then quickly, a couple of hours later, followed suit. They're in denial about this, and we need to make sure that passenger safety comes first again, because it's no good getting on a plane that's totally unsafe because somebody has got a load of money invested in Tesla and Elon Musk and these people.
Well, you can't make an omelette without killing a few hundred people, can you? I mean, we don't matter to these people, Tony. We never have done. We never will do. That's just about all we have time for today. Listen, first of all, thanks for jumping in last minute today. I really appreciate that, and I genuinely do. Second of all...
Anytime.
No, I know. I love talking to you. And secondly, the Ofcom result was a massive result for yourself, of course, personally, but for everybody. For everybody else that creates content for programs and podcasts like ourselves, it was a huge result.
Not least the Palestinians.
Absolutely right.
Hell of a time over there. Just in the same way as the racist apartheid in South Africa, the black people in South Africa had such a horrendous time. You know, there is exactly the same sort of situation. Actually now it's actually getting worse for the Palestinians than it was for the black South Africans in the 1980s. So, you know, more needs to be done than we did for South Africa if we possibly can.
Yeah, too right. Thisweek.org.uk. Check out the politics show on BCFM on Fridays. If you haven't before, if it turns out that you haven't, you don't know what you're missing. Terrific program. And Bilderberg.org, if you want to know all there is to know about a very important pillar of what goes on, is Bilderberg. Check it out, Bilderberg.org. Thanks, mate. I'll be in touch again real soon, as you know. Thanks for coming on, Tony.
Let me just put out a quick appeal. I've been chatting with various people about trying to figure out where this year's Bilderberg's going to be. We're thinking potentially Ireland.
Is that right? Wow.
Potentially, yep, because of what's been going on with the Brexit and the backstop and all that
stuff, the island.
So it's going to be in Europe, we think. So, and it's always around the end of May, beginning of June. But we're usually by this time of year, we've normally got a handle on it. Someone has leaked it, but not yet. So keep your eyes open.
Fantastic, Tone. Thanks, mate. Look after yourself. Speak again real soon.
Okay. Cheers,
Tony. Anytime, mate. The brilliant Tony Gosling there. Yeah, Ireland, that would be very interesting, wouldn't it? Somewhere in Kerry, maybe, or in Cork, possibly, if not Dublin or Belfast. It is,